Welcome to Whiskey Shenanigans. I'm your host, Randy Warren. Whiskey Shenanigans, where we help our listeners experience the world of whiskey, every aspect of life, as if it was accompanied by a glass of bourbon. The sports world on whiskey. Basically every part of life on whiskey. Whiskey Shenanigans is about getting exclusive interviews from Bourbon Row in Kentucky, where we can learn about the secrets that make our favorite bourbons unique. We will get inside the hearts and minds of many distillers and help you understand what and how they are achieving it. Whiskey Shenanigans is about going beyond boring podcasts featuring just tastings. Heck, what do you get out of that anyway? It's about bringing on guests and experiencing the entire world through whiskey. But be warned, if you're diving in and you want to participate in these riveting discussions, you will need to grab a glass or a dram and be prepared to be entertained. Hi, everybody. This is your host, Randy Warren, and I am very excited today to be joined by Michael Cameron. He is the owner and founder of Devil's River Distillery. And Devil's River is out in Texas. Whereabouts in Texas is that?
We're in South Central Texas, Randy, San Antonio.
Oh, San Antonio. Ah, it's a lovely area. I was out there not too long ago. One of my kids lived in Austin for a while. We visited San Antonio, the Riverwalk, and that's where the Riverwalk is, right?
It is. Yeah. Yes, our distillery is literally one block from the Riverwalk and a block and a half from the Alamo. So we're really close to where you were.
Yeah, and we visited the Alamo, and man, was it hot that day. It was a day in June, and the Alamo had those, they have those metal signs, and they say, don't touch them, right? Because if you touch them, you could cook an egg on those suckers. I mean, it was
any day of the year.
It was so hot. It was unbelievable. That's cool. So that's where you guys are located. And we're just excited to learn about you and what your journey has been like and how are things going. And so start by telling us where you started, Mike. I mean, how'd you get into this business?
Well, I came from a kind of a bourbon heritage family. My grandparents are from Louisville and my mother's from Louisville. And so always around it, you know, specifically bourbon my whole life. Had an interest early on in craft brewing and craft distilling and just did that as a hobby for many years and thought it might be a good business to start. So that's kind of how it all originally started back in 2007.
So you were doing something else completely different?
I had a tractor dealership before that. I had a commercial insurance agency before that. And whiskey is much more exciting than tractors and insurance. I can tell you that.
I can relate. I was doing something completely different before this. I was a registered investment advisor and a hedge fund manager for about 25 years. So, you know, it's like, okay, this is completely different. It's a lot more fun.
And absolutely.
Much more enjoyable.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's just, you know, whiskey is specifically distilled spirits are, you know, a celebration occasion, whether it's, you know, after a long day at work or you have friends come over and it's associated with, typically that in my mind, and that's kind of how I've always thought of it, is just a from the celebration side and, you know, getting together with friends and family.
It does. Everyone I talk to in this podcast, they bring up the fact that whiskey brings people together. And
agreed.
There's an old joke, not really joke, like funny joke, but just a, you know, saying that, like, you know, no good story ever started with, you know, so I was eating a salad and, you know, or I was drinking a glass of water and something happened. No, it always starts with, I was having a glass of whiskey with some friends and we decided to do something crazy, you know, or whatever. You know, that's what makes it kind of fun.
Absolutely.
So, you know, a little bit about you, you know, you've been in this business for a while, you know, what about your family? Like you told me about your parents. What about your wife? What does she say? Like, okay, honey, guess what? I'm quitting the tractor business. I'm going into the whiskey business.
You know, the old phrase behind every good man is a woman rolling her eyes. I have to say, I've definitely overmarried. My wife has been so supportive of my journey, and she's been right along there with me. We've been married for over 20 years, but she's been nothing but supportive. She's a whiskey drinker herself, so that helped. But when I first told my dad, who's very conservative, what I was going to do, I think he thought I was crazy. But it was kind of nice to see him before he passed, watch the business succeed and that maybe there was something to the idea of, because I've always done kind of things independent in my own way and not against the grain so much, just I like to try different things. And this was such a departure from most things he'd ever experienced. And really, I mean, I've been an entrepreneur most of my adult life, but to break into this was something completely, he couldn't wrap his head around. But as time went on, he really embraced the business, and it was good to see it being successful before he passed.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, my family is kind of the same in a way. I mean, my wife is very supportive, and my friends and my kids are like, where'd that announcer voice come from? You know, that's not what you sound like every day. It's like, well, yeah, of course. I mean, this is entertainment, I mean, it's supposed to be fun, and people need to be able to hear what you have to say and, whatever. So you got to be a little bit excited about what you're doing and let people know that it's fun and it's exciting. So,
yeah, I think the thing about the business that was the most appealing was, again, it's a celebration type of business. It's associated with the celebration of community and people. And so that's what attracted me to it in the beginning. And you have to work so hard in this business to develop your brand, whether it's a convention or a tasting or a ride along or going to package stores, liquor stores, bars, restaurants. I could care less about a party after 20 years of doing it. And I don't mean that disrespectful to parties, but I just, I've had all of that I can ever want. So now it's more focusing on the business and building the business and again it goes hand in hand. It's a very relationship type business to build a brand and you have to be out there. But I usually do it during the day and I don't usually attend the events at night as much anymore.
Right. I get it. Yeah. So, when your day is done and you're sitting down, which one of your whiskeys do you usually pull out?
My favorite is a Distiller Select. That's the Black Box.
Yep.
Yeah, 120 proof. I have a theory about whiskey, and sure, I don't know if it's true or not, but
I want to hear
if
this.
You think about the old days when saloon keepers used to get deliveries of whiskey to their saloons, probably by horse and buggy. They would purchase some barrels of whiskey. They'd put them on behind the bar,
right?
And they didn't know the next time that the delivery would probably come. So I think the practice of cutting whiskey with water probably began around that time to make it go further so they wouldn't run out. But I think whiskey, in my opinion, is best enjoyed just in its full strength barrel form. You get the most flavor, you get all the recognizable notes, and so that's a theory, but I think that's how it was originally intended to be consumed.
I think you're probably right. You were kind enough to send me some samples and I tried them all, and I thought for sure that the one you just mentioned was going to be my favorite as well. The high proof, it's like, everything like that. And then I thought, I probably won't like this one. I'm not that big of a rye guy. Let's see if you can make that show up. Can I make that show up?
Yes.
Yeah. This is 5-year-old aged straight rye whiskey. Fabulous.
Thank you.
Really,
it is. It is my second favorite, and it's not like it's a distant second. Those are neck and neck. Those are my two go-tos.
Right. That's I was quite surprised by that one. I was like, wow, I don't like jump at the rise, you know, like the rise on the shelf. Like behind me is Warren's American Whiskey Kitchen and, you know, the shelves and stuff. So I podcast from there when I'm in Florida and, you know, you can see all the stuff that's, you know, it's the usual stuff, right? It's like, you see this stuff everywhere. It's the George Stagg, it's the Colonel Taylor, it's the, you know, whatever. But it's nice to see something different. I think our listeners love the craft story, the medium-sized distillers. I guess you would call you a medium-sized distiller. Is that fair?
Yes.
I think they really like that because a lot of people maybe haven't had it. And so they're like, ooh, this is good. Now I can turn my friends onto it. And, you know, I know something they don't.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the state of the industry currently is there's 3,100 craft distilleries in North America. 75% of those are very small, producing between 1,000 and 1,500 cases a year. So there are some really unique things that you can find when you go out into the world and explore in the different towns, you know, and the industry has just exploded over the years, last 10 years especially.
Yeah.
And they're all unique. I mean, it's the terroir of the soil, the grain that's being grown in those regions. For us, it was, you know, all about Texas. We use Texas grown grain 100%. And it's hard to grow rye in Texas. There's very few varieties of rye that you can grow here.
Okay.
This particular variety is called the Brissetto rye. And, it has some pretty hardy, notes to it that really come through, which was surprising when we first did the distillation. And I think the other thing about rye is there's this misconception about rye whiskey. Obviously, before Prohibition, it was the number one selling type of whiskey was rye, but then they kind of lost favor. But they've made a huge comeback. I mean, rye sales are up over 2,000% in the last 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
But our rye is not what you might see typically as a 90, 95, 100% rye. Ours is much less rye. And the reason I did that is it's kind of like, in my opinion, an over hoppy beer. You can overdo it with anything.
Right.
And I didn't want to make it just one dimensional. And so it's only 51% rye. So it barely qualifies as a rye.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also got, you know, 45% corn and 4% malted barley, all grown and malted in the state of Texas. So it makes it unique in that fashion. And then the aging process that we have here also makes us unique. You mentioned earlier the heat.
Yes.
We have no shortage of that here. I joke and say we have two seasons, hot and hotter.
Right.
That's why I'm up in Colorado this week to get away from it, but it is definitely hot. The benefit of the heat is the accelerating aging effect that we get because, you know, that barometric pressure is increasing inside the vessel and it's pushing that distillate inside of the wood. So it spends more time in the wood than it does in the barrel itself. And so that's a unique characteristic of the region that we're from. So it's not only the grain, the terroir, the soil, the heat, all play a factor. And it's not just Texas, it's anywhere you go, there's different conditions. And so that's why it's great to explore and go learn about all these different brands of product out there that people can try. So I'm a fan of the industry and its offerings. There's so many choices out there. And, you know, whiskey as a product is a pretty simple recipe. It's just grain, yeast, and water. That's it.
Yeah.
But as you know, there's so many varieties of how it ends up tasting in the in the glass.
Yeah. They're just like you're saying, there's just endless, you know, variations. And, you know, ways to age it, ways to, you know, change the mash bill a little bit, change the yeast a little bit, like all these different things, they actually make a pretty big difference.
Absolutely. And in my opinion, the one that makes the biggest difference of all is the yeast. We have a proprietary yeast strain that we use we have 9 different expressions. And you know, there's something in the yeast strains called esters. And esters will bring forward certain notes. If you want to enhance certain notes, whether it's notes of heavier leather or tobacco or cinnamon or clove, that can be done by yeast. So that that reaction is fascinating. And I think that yeast doesn't get enough credit for the important role that it plays in the finish of a whiskey.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think most people, and myself included, when you first start getting into this, you start thinking, well, what is this yeast thing? You know, it's just like, oh, it just gets the reaction going and you know, it's not that important. And then you know, I've taken a few tours and, you know, you go to, I think it was it Four Roses? Can't remember which one. I was in Kentucky not too long ago, took a tour, and they had all the OSK, you know, and all these combinations of different yeast strains, like, and it's like, wow. I mean, you got to be a little bit of there's an art and a science to this. You got to be a little bit of a chemist on the science side to understand what you're talking about and, you know, how it really reacts and how it really works and changes the flavors.
Absolutely. I mean, we have never propagated our own yeast. It's way too complicated, and not so much that it can't be done, but to do it consistently as close to right every time is where the challenge lies. So I leave it to the yeast propagation specialist. We work with an outside lab who has our proprietary yeast strain recipe, and they produce that for us. But at the end of the day, it makes a very unique product.
And people always say because it's a familiar thing, people compare it to bread and sourdough bread. And it's like, oh, well, you have a yeast strain with sourdough bread and, you know, grandma had some and it's been in the fridge or whatever, the freezer, you take it out and you can divide it out and make some more and, you know, keep it. And I guess there's some comparison there, but it's quite a bit different as well.
Yeah, I mean, in some aspects, it's very similar. My wife, it's actually her hobby, is she makes sourdough bread. And golly, the varieties of different sourdough bread she's produced over the years, it's amazing. And
yeah.
And she's kind of drilled it down into three or four of her favorite, yeah, you know, that she produces. And they seem to be popular with friends and people that she lets try it.
Awesome. So let me ask you this question. So you go to a wedding or somewhere where maybe they don't have, God forbid, they don't have any of your expressions. What are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to order? I mean, you going to go to the wine or are you going to bring a flask?
Well, I can't say that I've never brought a flask. I've, you know, we have boots here in Texas, so flasks fit nicely in boots. Typically, we'll drink whiskey, you know, usually early in the evening. For some reason, I always start out with beer, and then towards about the middle, towards the end of the event, I'll go to whiskey. So it's just creature of habit, I suppose. But I will try to find what I believe to be the best whiskey that I like that they're offering. But if they have the standards, which is so common for weddings to have the Crown Royal and Jack Daniels and Jim Beam, and I may drink vodka.
There you go. I like that answer. That's clever. I'm not going to pick any of those. That's clever. I like that. Yeah, I have the same problem. I never quite, and I ask everybody these questions because I don't know what to do. And I'm like, what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? It's like, okay, what do you have? Wild turkey, like the bottom of the line wild turkey thing or something? It's like, okay. I was at a wedding in Italy a couple of weeks ago, and that was the thing. I mean, Italy's all about the wine anyway. I was surprised they had any bourbon at all. I really didn't see any. And then, like, hiding behind a punch bowl over there, I found this little bottle. I'm like, okay, let's at least do that. Enough of the Chianti and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Let's go with at least something familiar, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I like all types of beverages, really. You know, I love trying nice wines and craft beers and different types of beers. But typically, I'm going to drink whiskey. It's going to be neat. I don't mix it with anything. I don't have it, yep, even ice in the glass. I just like it in its neat, pure form.
Yep. Yep. So what do you like with your whiskey? Are you a bourbon and burger guy? Or are you a Chilean sea bass guy, like filet mignon in a bourbon? What's your favorite?
Well, you know, I think bourbon can go with anything. I really do. I've had it with any type of food you can probably think of, but I've also, not that we're talking about tequila today, but being in San Antonio and expanding into this agave bourbon that we came out with. I spent a lot of time down in Oaxaca and Jalisco learning about, you know, not only the tequila industry, but the mezcal industry. And it's fascinating. If you take the time to go down there and research and spend time with those artists and producers, it's very similar to the bourbon industry. There's a lot of varieties and there's a lot of different, notes that you're going to get in certain varieties of agave. I think it's just the entire spirits industry itself is fascinating to me, because no matter what region of the world you travel to, they have their native spirit. And whether it's Pisco in Peru or, you know, cognac or Oaxacan mezcal,
right?
It's just fascinating, and how it came to be and how it's part of their culture and how they have the appellation protection for each one of their spirit categories, which it's smart to do that, because it makes it synonymous with that region. And it certainly played a lot into these tariffs that are going on right now. Bourbon is only produced in the United States. The U.S. is less than 5% of the world's population. And we want the world to know more about bourbon. And I think, like it or not, I think some of these tariffs needed to be renegotiated. And specifically India, they've got 150% tariff right now, or have had, on American spirits coming into their country. And we were charging them very little to come into the United States. Well, that's not fair trade, but there has been recent negotiations, and it's probably going to be some saber rattling for a little bit, but I'm confident that, for instance, India and the U.S. will work out a trade agreement specifically for spirits that will allow the bourbon market to open up in India. They have it's one of the largest whiskey consumption countries in the world, and with a massive population that loves whiskey, and
right.
And they don't know much about bourbon, because there's just a few bourbons over there.
Wow.
And so we see that as a new opportunity. We just signed a new distribution contract with a distributor over there that we're excited to start exporting into the fall. And so I think the more you see the fair trade between countries, the U.S. and other countries, you're going to see bourbon start to make bigger moves in other countries. And right now, U.S. is the king for bourbon. And U.S. is also the king for a lot of other things, including tequila. We drink more tequila here than Mexico does.
That's great. Well, we have a lot of population, Latin population from all over South America and Central America and Mexico that love that. But I think bourbon is just very approachable type of whiskey. It's almost like if I hadn't tried Scotch first, it would have been difficult to enjoy Scotch after bourbon. But I tried Scotch first, and I was like, and then as soon as you try a bourbon after that, you're like, this is so easy to drink. It's like, it's a little bit sweeter, and it doesn't have that peatiness, which I like in the Scotch, but you have to get used to it a little bit.
Absolutely. It's as my mom used to say, an acquired taste. I enjoy Scotch as well. And it's like going back to the too much rye. You can do too much peat. You can do too much of anything. And I think having that balanced, in my opinion, the balanced mash bill, I think appeals to more people. We're not trying to appeal to 0.1% of the population. We're trying to appeal to the masses with our products. We want them to be approachable. We offer 9 different expressions, so you may not like all 9 of our products, and that's fine. But we think that if you try them all, there's definitely one that'll stand out to you and that you'll like it. And that's all I care about, is just you like one thing that we produce. And yep, that's what matters to me.
And I think getting into India is really smart. Obviously, massive, huge population. What is it? It's a billion. It's more than a billion people, isn't it?
Yes.
Might even be 2. I'm not sure. But it's...
Yeah.
It's a lot of people, and so there's a lot of opportunity there, to get the whiskey drinkers or people, any spirit drinker, to like pick up a bourbon and go, what's this about? And then they go, oh, this stuff is great. Look at the flavors and everything like that. And that's probably why I liked your Select series, your Devil Select series, because, it's it had so much more flavor. You know, I think a little bit higher proof, but it's not crazy. You know, it's very still approachable, but the flavor really comes out in the higher proof. Although I had to say, your basic bourbon, very, very good. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, you've got the term small batch that you hear a lot in our industry, and a lot of people don't know what small batch really means. I think it's subject to interpretation, but typically as an industry in the bourbon industry specifically, we recognize small batch as 125 barrels or less. So we take 125 barrels or less, and we blend those together to create that consistency. And going back to what we were talking about earlier about how yeast can affect the finished product, it's not easy to get that same consistent profile every batch, even with blending those barrels together. But we get pretty darn close to where the average consumer is not going to be able to tell the difference from batch to batch to batch. The distiller select, however, that is a limited number of barrels, and those were hand-selected as just exceptional, and how they marry together. It's cut very little bit with what's a flat 120 proof. And we have proprietary finishing processes we use on all of our whiskeys that don't take away flavor, but take away some of that high-end distraction of too much heat, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Some people love the burn and the heat, and I don't mind it, but
yeah.
I think, again, you can overstate that note, and you lose what you're trying to achieve, which is letting people try all the different notes
within the
whiskey, which is those other elements that people look for. So we try to find that balance, and it's taken a lot of time to learn that. But we have pretty good blenders in our operation.
So when you're aging these barrels, what's your technique? What's your differentiation? Are you putting, like some people put staves in them of different flavors of wood and, you know, put it in to finish it? Or some people put it in a barrel that was used for, you know, cognac or something like that, or rum or whatever, and they finish it in those things. So what kinds of finishings do you guys do?
Well, we use the standard 53-gallon, American white oak barrel.
Sure.
For aging. The rickhouse itself, we're unique in that our rickhouse is air-conditioned, but we don't use the air conditioning unless we're getting ready to do a barrel dump. So, you know, you got to change the temperature inside that room to allow the distillate to come back into the barrel. That way you get a larger yield, because otherwise it'll be stuck in the wood and you'll give away too much. So we, you know, in the metal building in San Antonio, it's hot. I mean, you can walk through the rickhouse in like this time of year in August, and literally if you take a deep breath, you'll feel your lungs burning. And I'm not kidding. The angel share is so high.
Wow.
It's actually in the air, pretty heavy. It's not just like going to a Kentucky rickhouse and you smell whiskey in there. This is alcohol in the air.
Right.
And wow. So it's good in one element in that it ages faster, but it's bad in that our angel share is higher. So we get to that point of diminishing returns to where we, you know, you lose too much. And so we've got some really nice barrels coming along that are probably 8 or 9 years old now, and I'm looking forward to releasing those. And going back to your question about what do we do different, we've got some finishing techniques we're doing with some other woods on some of those. So we'll have some new releases coming out in the next couple of years, which will include things like French oak port barrels. So right. We've got some fun stuff we're doing with those. But for the most part, it's bourbon. So it's got to be brand new American charred white oak barrels. And we use a number 3 and a number 4 char for the different expressions.
Right. Nice. So tell me about the agave one. Is you were telling me a little bit about it, but like, did you, it's pretty sweet. So it's almost like it's halfway to an old fashioned.
Right. Well, you know, I going down to Mexico so much because we export down there as well. I love the culture down there. It gets a bad rap, you know, Mexican, especially interior Mexico. They're wonderful people, wonderful culture, very family oriented. I've had so many great connections and people I've met over the years down in Mexico. So I get frustrated with, you know, the bad publicity, which some of it certainly earned. But it's a great country. It's got some beautiful places and some beautiful people. But so I think that influenced my decision to try to do something. It's my belief, I think, that we were the first flavored bourbon, which was very controversial in the beginning because bourbon purists, whiskey nerds, we all like our whiskey. We're very protective of bourbon. So when somebody comes out with a flavored bourbon, it caused a little disruption, and I took some heat for it, but it's now way more accepted. 25% of all whiskey sold in the United States is flavored now.
Wow.
So a quarter of it and growing. So the first flavored expression we did was a coffee using real coffee beans and agave. And that's done very well. And the second was the agave bourbon. And so I had no idea how it would go. I had no idea how it would be accepted. But one thing I did know, the number one selling whiskey in Texas was Crown Royal, which is light and sweet. So it told me that Texans specifically maybe had a palate for lighter and sweeter profile on their whiskey. It's not bourbon. It's Canadian whiskey. So I thought that, hey, that maybe there's something to this. But so I basically went out and researched and found the largest agave producer in Mexico. He has 5 tequilerias that he owns where they produce tequila, but he also is the largest agave farmer in Mexico. Great guy. We've become good friends. And I started importing fermented agave through Laredo to our facility in San Antonio and blending. And it's taken off like a rocket ship. It's our number one selling spirit. And it's not for everybody. It's not for the whiskey purist who just wants to drink a straight, good quality, high-end bourbon.
Right.
It's made with good bourbon, but it is it was to really appeal to more people. So, you know, younger people who are drinking less and also don't drink whiskey as much as, you know, people that are from our generations. Also women who a lot of women drink whiskey, but a lot of women don't.
Yeah.
And also whiskey is typically more popular during the colder months of, October through February.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted a whiskey that would be more relevant year round. And so the agave bourbon has achieved all those things. It's made whiskey more relevant year round. It appeals to women who aren't whiskey drinkers. It appeals to young people who weren't whiskey drinkers. So I think that we've opened up a whole new category of consumers that we didn't have before.
Yeah, and we made espresso martinis last night with your coffee bourbon, and really enjoyed them. They were great. We brewed up some extra coffee and we mixed it together, and my wife and my daughter-in-law, they thought it was fantastic. So they really enjoyed that.
Awesome.
As well.
I'm glad to hear it. You know, everything we do is all natural. We don't use anything artificial, and that's really important. And you can taste real. We use real agave. We use real coffee beans. We really roast our coffee beans on a Vienna roast. But there's nothing artificial in anything we make. So that's important.
Yeah. So right now, are you working with anybody like a friend or a relative or somebody like that, that you're like trying to teach about like bourbon and help them along their journey or anybody like that?
Well, my whole family works with me, which is great.
They're all versed in it. They all know it well.
They all, yes. I mean, my boys are in their 30s now and they've been working for me since they were 14.
Wow.
Used to raise some eyebrows that, you know, these young teenagers were working in a whiskey distillery, but, they weren't drinking it. They were on the bottling line and it was a family business, but I didn't think they were drinking it, but I may have.
maybe a little beer there. Yeah.
Right. But no, it's been great to have them, you know, in the industry with me. One of my sons is the manager of the downtown distillery and tasting room. Another son is outside sales and covers the state of Texas. And the other son is a production manager and blender at our facility. So all three. And then, of course, my wife is the controller of the money, which is a good person to have in control of that.
That's right. That's right. So out of your 9 different expressions that you have, which, if God were creating them, which one would he have created first?
You know, I don't know. I think if I had to guess, if the God that I believe in, I think would have probably chosen agave bourbon, because it is, okay, it is all about, you know, accepting other cultures.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, appealing to more people.
Yep.
And more widely accepted. So I'd have to go with the agave bourbon. I know it sounds crazy, but again, if you meet a hardcore whiskey drinker, they might try it and say, oh, this is too sweet. And that's fine. You know, but I can tell you, for every one of those, there's 100 people who absolutely love the agave bourbon. So,
wow.
But I have something for him too, or her too. I've got the 120 proof, you know, yep, distiller select. So yep, we try to, like I say, have something for everybody.
Absolutely. And if your personality were a bourbon, what would be the tasting notes?
Oh, I'm, you know, a little rough around the edges sometimes. So maybe the distiller select, but
a little spicy.
I'm friendly. I'm a little spicy sometimes. Yes, but it leaves you with a warm, fuzzy feeling, hopefully at the end, and we'll get along and be friends.
Definitely. And you know, I mean, we were talking, I hope you don't mind if I bring it up. We were talking earlier, about some distribution problems and things like that.
Yes.
And that seems to mostly be behind you, no? Or is it still working through it a little bit?
We are still working through it. What you're referring to is, you know, before COVID, we had a sales force of about 15 people across the United States that were helping represent our brand. And, you know, COVID hit, and like so many companies, we had to furlough our sales staff and our employees because there was no work to be done, because there was no accounts that you could call on.
Right.
COVID went away for a period. We brought them back. Then COVID came back again. We thought it would be around for, you know, a couple months, and right, it was 2 years minimum. Our grand opening of our distillery was March of 2020. So horrible timing.
Wow.
We spent all this money in a brand new distillery and couldn't be open to the public for another year. So April of 21 is when we finally were able to open our doors. And, the landscape of the downtown cities across the United States has changed, you know, people not officing as much downtown. So the foot traffic, pre-pandemic that we saw, it was night and day compared to the foot traffic that you see even today. So I don't care what anybody says, we have not recovered from COVID, and especially in the, you know, visitors and tourist sector of the industry. But it's improving. We've got challenges, but so we were approached by Sazerac, which is, you know, one of the largest producers of distilled spirits in the United States, and they wanted to be our distribution partner. And so we signed an agreement, and we went on our way. And after a couple of years, it just became an unsustainable relationship. It was just too much margin that they were taking. So it was really difficult to stay profitable. So they were required to reach certain goals each year. And the last year, which was 2024, they didn't reach that goal. So we had the opportunity to exit the relationship, which we did. And then they turned around and filed a lawsuit against us. And so we were forced to file a bankruptcy to protect the company. So it was a very difficult decision.
Yeah.
You know, there's the term bankruptcy gets such a bad, you know, has such a bad connotation. And there are a variety of, you know, bankruptcies, Chapter 7, Chapter 11, Chapter 13. And I didn't know anything about bankruptcy until about 6 months ago. But
and this is the reorganization bankruptcy, right? This isn't a liquidation bankruptcy. This is
that's right. Yeah, this is, you know, after the CARES Act was passed during COVID, they came out with the CARES Act, which was a new type of new and improved bankruptcy. I guess it's to allow businesses to get back on their feet. So it's called Subchapter 5 under 11. And so that's what we did, but it protected the company. And we should, if everything goes as planned, be out of bankruptcy by this October.
Nice.
So it should be less expensive. It should be quicker, and you're able to get back on your feet quicker. So it's been a painful paperwork process to go through. There is a lot of lawyers and paperwork involved, but it's been a learning process, and we are stubborn, hardworking people, and we will survive and push forward. But it was something that was forced upon us. It wasn't something we wanted to do, but it ultimately served its purpose, which was protecting the company,
right,
from that lawsuit.
And a lot of distillers are struggling with like distribution and getting shelf space, you know, like which is it's really strange. You know, you go into Total Wine, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and you know, you find out, oh well, you know, they don't even have anything from the Buffalo Trace Distillery. What? You don't have any Colonel Taylor, you don't have any Stag, you don't have any of this stuff? No, they're not distributing any to us. They're just giving it to bars and restaurants and stuff. And then everybody else, though, is like fighting for the shelf space, you know, and it's like as you said, there's so many brands, 3,100 brands in the United States. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, the old Kevin Costner phrase from that movie, you build it and they will come, is not true.
Yeah, definitely not. I've never found
you can't
that
build
to be true.
You can't build a distillery and expect to be, you know, overnight success. That's just the harsh reality of our industry, and it's only gotten harder.
Yeah.
Tito Beverage is it's actually his last name is Beverage, but Tito has been a friend of mine. He's from San Antonio for years, and he was a pioneer in our industry. It'd be very difficult to repeat what Tito did. I mean, he's worldwide and had a lot of struggles in the beginning, but he pushed through. But I think, you know, nowadays to start a new vodka distillery or whiskey distillery, the key to success is, number one, you have to have good juice, good products, good packaging, a good team. But then you've got to be willing to spend a lot of money. And I'm not talking about a little bit of money. I'm talking about a lot of money if you want to grow your brand, because it is so competitive. And like you said earlier, everyone's fighting for shelf space. You've got a lot of the larger chains now that are carrying private labels, which are being contract distilled, and they make better margins. So they are, you've got even more brands added to the ones that you have to deal with. And which ones are those retailers going to push? They're going to push the ones they make the most margins on.
Right,
so,
like Costco or something like
that.
Yeah,
the industry has the industry has a lot of headwinds, especially for craft. And as far as your distribution question or comment, you know, there's two of the largest distributors in the United States are Republic National and Southern Wine Glazers. And I know a lot of the people that work there. They're great, great people, great companies. But in reality, they don't have the bandwidth to support all of these brands. They just don't. I mean, if you're a sales rep out there and you have a territory and you've been given a portfolio of 100 brands, how are you going to be loyal to any of those?
Yeah.
I mean, you just can't. And the ones you will be loyal to are the ones that you're getting money or incentive on.
Right.
So you've got that obstacle. So what we're seeing lately is a migration of smaller distributors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably, if I had to recommend to a new upcoming distributor, don't think that if you sign up with a big boy, that's a good thing for your brand, because it's not necessarily. You want to find someone who doesn't have as big a portfolio, who has enough sales staff to go out and proof that has relationships,
right,
and that can present the brand to those customers. So the industry has changed. I mean, when I first started our first product 20 years ago, we went into Republic and they welcomed us with open arms, but that's not the same company, the same model anymore.
Right.
It's not.
That's, you know, it's the same in every industry. Like I said, I was running a hedge fund for a long time, and, you know, a lot of distributors would come and they would say, you know, we can distribute your product, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, how are you going to get the word out about our product when your guys, they have these big old briefcases and they show up at somebody's office, and which one are they going to pull out of the briefcase? They got 100 of them in there. Which one are they going to pull out? Do they know anything about us? Do they really know what we do? Can they explain it? You know, do they even know what the track record is? You know, so it's like you, have they even tried the whiskey? You know, it's like, do they even know that it's good? You know, you go out there and it's like, hey, let's sit down and have a dram together. You know, that's much more, you know, or let's collaborate in some way, you know, or whatever. It's so much more effective when you're doing it, like you say, with a smaller distributor. than with one of the large.
Yeah, and I'll say this. I don't want to say I've totally become jaded about this because the agave bourbon was a very nice surprise to me. It's become our lightning in a bottle.
Wow.
We haven't spent a ton of money on marketing it, and it's grown organically. So if you do produce something that's unique and different that people migrate towards, that appeals to the masses, then you'll be successful. It just takes a little bit longer if you don't have the big, you know, liquor conglomerate dollars behind you. But so I still do believe that there is a possibility of growing a brand organically, but it's just not as easy as it used to be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had Goldman Sachs approach us about distributing our hedge fund to all of their, through all of their channels, their sales channels and everything like that. And, you know, we went down a pretty long road with them. And in the final analysis, one of their last steps was just talking to, not us talking to them, talking their, you know, inside people, talking to all their distributors, all their salespeople and everything like that. And what came back was, we don't really know how to sell an options-based strategy. I said, what? You're Goldman Sachs. What do you mean you don't know how to sell an options-based strategy? You guys, you know, I was on the sell side of the business, not the buy side. I was on the sell side of the business for a long time. And I know that you guys use, you know, we used to help you with foreign exchange options and derivatives of all sorts and types and everything like that. And they're like, a lot of our customers are still like asking, like, what's an ETF or what's different about that from a mutual fund? And it's still very, very basic out there, you know, in the real world. And it's like, wow, that's hard to wrap your mind around.
It's eye-opening, right? I mean, it really is.
Yeah. But you're right. I mean, you have a great product.
On the distribution side, one last thing, and that is the big liquor conglomerates. And I'm talking about Diageo, Pernod Ricard, Constellation, Proximo. They all have some pretty big leverage when they sign a distribution agreement. And so, you know, they're capturing the time and attention of that distributor more than any brand will get. And that's what people have to remember if you're in this business, that, you know, you're not going to get the priority, you know, that those companies get. They already have distribution. They've already got, you know, hundreds of thousands of cases that they sell every year. There's only so many hours, man hours, woman hours of people to go out there and work your brand. And, you know, any company is going to focus on what sells the fastest and the most.
Yep.
That's just about the bottom line and making their board happy. And so I get it, but I think there's a real opportunity for smaller craft distributors in this country right now. And we're seeing some new distributors pop up that are specifically focusing on craft spirits that are doing well.
Mm-hmm. How about like mergers and acquisitions? Are those sort of, you see that in your, you know, when you're out there in this craft industry? I mean, people are struggling to get shelf space and distribution and all that. And like, you know, what about, you know, M&A so that they can get a bigger presence or become part of one of those that already have big distribution?
Yes, M&A in our industry has been going on for quite a while. Under the craft side, it slowed down and started slowing down in 23 and 24. And I still think there's a lot of money, as we always say, on the sidelines waiting for interest rates to drop. And I think we'll see some more bolt-on acquisitions from some of these larger conglomerates. But
yep.
Right now, it's a little bit of a kind of a wait and see. There's been a lot of Texas M&A. TX Whiskey out of Fort Worth was purchased by Pernod Ricard. You know, you had Deep Eddy purchased by Heaven Hill.
Mm-hmm.
You had Balcones purchased by Diageo. You had Yellow Rose out of Houston purchased by Zamora. And you recently up in Dripping Springs, there was an acquisition from that John Paul DiGiorno that had the Patron. He did a recent acquisition of a company up there. And we've been approached by some liquor conglomerates over the years. So I think Texas is unique in that way. We probably have had our fair share of M&A activity. I don't know what it is. You know, we obviously have a lot of pride down here in Texas, and Some people look at it as bragging, but we're just proud to be here and proud of our state. But,
yeah.
And we welcome people to come visit our state. We see ourselves as a friendly state, but I think Texas is recognized, starting to become recognized as a real whiskey state. Wasn't always that way for sure. I mean, whiskey's only been around for 20 years in Texas, but
right.
Between the whiskey distilleries that are producing great products now in Texas, we're getting a lot of, you know, national and international notoriety.
Right. Sounds great. Well, that's, I guess one more question, just a fun question. If you're traveling, if you're on a journey and you're on a road trip, you know, what song would you be playing as you're crossing the country?
Well, I grew up, you know, my father was such a fan of old traditional country music, you know, Hank Williams Sr. And so I like all kinds of music. I like blues and jazz and rock and country and classical even, but I typically would listen to, you know, some nice road music of country, probably a fast moving country song, to get me across the country. But, that's another thing that goes hand in hand with our industry is all the great people I've met. I've had the pleasure of meeting so many great musicians. We've sponsored George Strait's annual military fundraiser for the last 15 years and nice. Gotten to know George and his band and his family very well. Jamie Johnson and Dean Dillon and Kid Rock. And I've got to meet all these people over the years. And it just kind of goes hand in hand with that celebration, you know, the whiskey business. So without being in this business, I never would have had those opportunities to meet those folks and get to know their stories. And so music to me goes hand in hand with whiskey.
That is absolutely the case. I 100% agree. And that's all I got for you today. It's just a quick, you know, quick chat. And we want to, you know, basically we're going to make clips out of this. We're going to send you those clips so you can use them for social media. We're going to post them on our social media. We're going to basically try to help you get the word out about the fact that you guys are making great stuff.
Randy, I really appreciate your interest in the company and your time and setting all this up. And I'm sorry I didn't have a fancy background because I'm up at the place in Colorado this week. But normally I'd have my still in the back to make it more eye appealing instead of looking at my ugly mug. But thank you for your time and your interest in our company.
No problem, and thank you, Mike. And let's keep in touch. This has been a great conversation. I enjoyed it very, very much, and you know, I enjoyed your product very much as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And come down and see us when you're in San Antonio.
Definitely will. You know, I'm sure I'll have an opportunity. Let's see. I still got friends in Houston. My son moved from Austin to Charlotte, so he's not there anymore. But I still have friends in Houston, which is not too far away from where you're at.
Well, now you've got a friend in San Antonio.
Absolutely. So I will stop in. I'll drop you an email first. I won't surprise you.
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks,
Mike.
Have
a good rest of your week.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Okay, Whiskey Shenanigans fans, welcome to the shenanigans portion of the podcast. And as we look around in the sports world this week, and we tried to find the most craziest thing or the dumbest thing that happens recently, I can't help coming back to this crazy play with the Los Angeles Dodgers. So bases are loaded. The Dodgers are up. The guy hits a massive shot to long, long, long center field. Okay. This is going to be a grand slam home run, right? The outfielder, Sal Frelick, reaches over the wall and pulls the ball down and stops it from being a grand slam. Juggles the ball, has it in his glove, immediately throws it into the infield, who relays it to home plate. To home plate? What's going on here? So apparently the guy on third decides to tag. So he tags up. And he comes sliding into home plate. He's out. But everybody thinks he's safe. Because nobody knows that the outfielder didn't catch the ball. What happened was Sal Frelick robbed the Dodgers hitter of a grand slam, but as he's doing so, he's juggling the ball and it hits the wall. And that's just like a double off the wall. Like, you can't let it hit the wall and catch it and say that's an out. It's not an out. So it's not an out. So that's not the first out, right? He throws it in knowing he didn't catch it. He's like, okay, there's a force play. Well, the catcher, apparently pretty smart guy himself, he knew it was a force out. So he didn't even bother to tag the guy. So the guy comes sliding in. The announcer goes, he's safe. He's not safe. The umpire goes, he's out. Then the catcher looks around, can't believe his eyes. The original guy who was standing on second base is still standing on second base. That's like unbelievable. So the catcher jogs down to third base, steps on the bag, and gets him out. And the inning's over. And everybody's like, wait, what? And it turns into not a triple play at all, because it was already one out in the inning. It was the most unusual. You know, they number the players in the outfield and all that sort of stuff. So it went from 8-6-2 double play, probably the most unusual double play ever in baseball. And everybody stood around going, what just happened? And instead of a grand slam where the Dodgers put on four runs on the board, they're out of the inning. But it's also not a triple play because there was already one out. And he also didn't catch it because he bobbled it and hit the wall. And it also was a force play because he didn't catch it. And the catcher knew that, and the umpire knew that, but nobody else did. Unbelievable set of circumstances that happened in that game. So very interesting. Swinging around the NFL, not really anything all that exciting happened this weekend. Yeah, great game between the Steelers and the Bengals. Shouldn't have been a great game. The Steelers should have killed them. Bengals are terrible. But Mike Tomlin is terrible on the road on Thursday night. He is now 2-10 on the road in his career on Thursday night. So was it really that surprising? Not really. But if you're just a casual fan, great game. I mean, lots of lead changes and lots of scoring. I think it ended 32-31. So really good game. Tampa Bay was getting shellacked last night. You know, so many interesting things going on all around the league. The most unusual thing probably is that the Indianapolis Colts are playing amazing. They are just playing lights out right now. And I don't know what's going to happen with that. I have a feeling that they're going to kind of be like Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay ran into a bit of a buzzsaw against Detroit and didn't work out so well for them. And I think when Indianapolis starts playing some really good teams, they may have some difficulty. So we'll see about that. But the Dodgers play was really interesting, really exciting, and really confusing. So if you watched it and you didn't know what happened, now you know what happened. Thanks, Whiskey Shenanigan fans. See you in 2 more weeks for the next episode of Whiskey Shenanigans Podcast. Well, Whiskey Shenanigans fans, thanks for joining us this week. We'll have another episode coming out in 2 weeks, and we're going to get that regular 2-week cadence going, and you can always look forward to one every other week. So thanks again, and here's a clip from our next episode. Drew Hanisch from Whiskey Lore Podcast. And Drew is as famous. His podcast is amazing. And you should check it out if you haven't. I have. It's great. And so we wanted to have a conversation today. Get to know you a little bit, Drew.
Perfect. Well, thanks for having me on. It's nice to not be in the driver's seat today.
Absolutely.